Welcome to Cannon Fodder, a behind-the-scenes look at the Glass Cannon Podcast.
For Highbury!
For Highbury!
Thank you. It took long enough. What's going on, guys? Welcome to Cannon Fodder. My name is Joe O'Brien.
And I am Deacon Emeritus Troy LaValle.
You're not religious in the least.
I am an ordained deacon. That is, they get ordained, right?
Yeah. I think they do, actually.
I was voted in, actually. It was a write-in candidate.
Really threw me off there with that one.
I gotcha.
I wasn't prepared. What's going on, guys? Welcome back to our behind-the-scenes look at the Glass Cannon Podcast, episode 77.
Mm.
The battle against Lockmore Ettergun rages on, finishes in this one, but man, was that a long one. We're going to talk today about the twists and turns of that combat, including a special little, and you just told me this before we hit record, behind-the-scenes look at how you changed that combat.
A little bit of tweakage.
A little bit of tweakage as it was going.
It almost was completely changed to something even more intense.
Wow. Really interesting. We'll talk about the confirmed death of Ingrahild, love stories in Pathfinder, and gifting powerful weapons to NPCs. Plus, bonus at the end here, we are going to talk, Troy and I are going to brainstorm together to teach you how to do the most devious, awful, nasty things to your players as a GM, courtesy of a fantastic listener mail.
I'm not going to have to dig too deep on that one.
No. I didn't even give you, remember last time or two times ago, I gave you homework.
Right.
I knew you would need no homework for this one. You'd be able to improv it right off the top of your head.
Bebop and scat some evil.
As I said, the battle rages on. You finish it with a cliffhanger right before a charge from Willamette Keswick.
Mm.
We open up with an exciting charge from Willamette, his first charge in combat. And of course, I'm an idiot. So
go on.
I go right in.
I'm
and
not going to stop you.
I go right in and just screw up the rules. That's the first thing that I do in my first charge with Willamette. And you had told me specifically, you were like, know the rules of your new character. Read the rules on ride checks. Read the rules on handle animal. Know everything backwards and forwards before we start recording so that we don't have these looking things up while we are recording. I thought I had a handle on it. And in my defense, I really didn't do anything too bad in rules as written, but there are some rules as interpreted that could throw things off. So we had, you know, I didn't have time this week to sit down and do a We Are Stupid, and I really didn't want to flesh out how it's a hotly debated issue. But basically, I started this charge into Lightmore Ettergun and then drove right through his square.
And you hear me say, like, oh, so you just go right through his space? And you're like, yep. And I'm thinking to myself, nope. But it was such a moment. I was like, I'm not 100% sure. You seemed very confident. So I'm like, I'm not going to grind things to a halt right now. It's not a game breaker.
Right.
Let's let this cool moment happen.
Right. And it just goes to show you, like, when you're playing with your GM at home, just speak very confidently.
Right.
Look him in the eye. Look her in the eye. Give a sharp nod and say, yes, I looked it up. And then you get what you want.
I'm like, all right, well.
You know what, something, Troy? That's how the world works,
by the way. That's true.
You can be a total idiot and have everything go your way with a confident nod and a smile.
You're living proof.
So I guess I just thought that the feat ride by attack allowed you to plow straight through a line, you know, through your charge. And by the very wording of it, it says that you can continue the charge in a straight line, your full movement speed of the charge. And to me, you always charge directly at an enemy's space. But what we had talked about afterwards was maybe you need to be a little bit more like tilting, as it were.
It's a tilt.
You ride by the side of the target and hit them sort of from the side, which I did not have room to do in that room. But I mean, I still could have hit him and done the damage. I just couldn't have passed through.
Continue.
I would have had to stay right there, you know, in melee range of him and his horrifying spear. So
yeah.
I'm sorry, we are stupid. Going forward, we're going to make an effort to make sure that I am sort of to one side or the other of an enemy and passing by them sideways to do a ride-by attack.
I mean, it's a cool feat. There's fly-by attack, there's ride-by attack. Being able to move is enormous. And
yeah.
Those are the only... there's probably, I think, another feat that allows you to do something
Spring attack.
Move attack, move. It's just great. We just got to make sure we do it right. We've never dealt with lances and ride checks and all this.
Right,
so.
And this is why we were doing it. We wanted to experiment with it. And, well, we learned our lesson and should be better going forward. Speaking of spring attack, by the way, That's a little tidbit. If you want to build a rogue, what a fantastic feat tree. Start with dodge at an early level, then get mobility, which gives you plus four to your AC against attacks of opportunity. If you provoke them by moving through enemy squares.
Which it's great because you'll just say, to hell with it. I'll provoke attacks of opportunity all the time because you always get a plus four when you do it if you have mobility.
Exactly. Yeah, you'll get hit sometimes, but not nearly as much as if you didn't get that plus four. And then it builds to spring attack, which allows you to move, attack, move. And in any direction.
It's great. It's
pretty awesome feat. So we continue the combat. It's getting a little bit dicey. Obviously, Ingrahild goes down. We learned that at the end of last week's episode. And then, you know, we have Baron coming in. Baron comes in later, but Nestor coming in, Della coming in, and eventually Baron. And we think that this is, you know, going to turn the tide of the battle. And when Baron gets in there, in his grief, at seeing Ingrahild, he misfires.
Isn't it? I always love when the dice reflect the emotion because it's ultimately impossible. But that when it happens, that's why you always gotta say, "Well, it makes total sense."
Yeah,
he came in and just as he's pulling the trigger, what the misfires?
Yeah, but the other thing is like it's like a horoscope because if he rolled a natural 20, you could be like, he saw Ingrahild down and was like so upset. But either way, it is. I love when the die. But you know what's better about that though, because the way that it went, it makes it look like grief, which to me is much more meaningful than making it look like, you know, he's revenge, like badass revenge.
Right.
So I think that was an interesting way. And, you know, that's just that emergent storytelling that comes from rolling dice that you and I just really love.
Oh, I love it.
And yeah, you jumped right on that. And then within seconds, Della goes down to some like touch attack.
Yeah.
I can't remember if you told us. I don't think you told us like, what it was, but she dropped a point of dex and then began flailing around on the ground in convulsions for, I guess I can only assume 1d4 rounds, but ends up being 3 rounds. We just completely lose Della.
Yeah, it was called Torturous Touch, and he had a plus 12 to his touch attack. But it was just the way it worked. Like, with that spear, I can only attack things that are 10 feet away from me.
Right.
And so when Della got super close, and I was backed up against the wall because you guys were flanking me on every possible position, all I could do was hand out 2d6 damage plus 1d6 dex damage. And convulsions.
Oh, man. You must have been so happy when you hit Della with that because of the dex. But then you only roll a 1 on the die.
Right.
Which is a huge break for Della. But
imagine
still.
6 dex. Imagine.
Oh, man.
Just brutal.
But still, she goes down in convulsions. Just.
Your main damage dealer in terms of melee. Out.
Yeah. And caster-wise. You know what I mean? Just out. And it's just such a disturbing image. So then we think Nestor can save the day. We still have massive damage output on this team. We still have Nestor. However, Nestor's damage output in 2 consecutive rounds goes into allies, courtesy of our new house rule.
Insane.
One shot into Della on the ground in convulsions. He hits her with an arrow.
Della's talk not about soon to forget about that, I'm sure.
Talk about kicking you when you're down. And then he hits Willibit with an arrow.
Yep.
Now, this is in 2 consecutive rounds. I do believe he hit him. He hit Lockmore as well in those rounds, but I think he hit Willibit for 19 points of damage.
The odds of that happening are so, so tiny. You have to roll less than a 1 to 10 on a D100 if you miss, which he shouldn't miss if he's got a plus 4. He's not taking that minus 4 because of precise shot. It's insanity that happened twice.
Skid was so furious. You remember after the game, he was just like, get rid of it. No, get rid of it. He is so angry.
Skid is not forgiving.
No, but it is. But it is. You're right. It's such a long shot.
Yeah.
It's a ridiculous long shot. So hopefully we can come back around on that. But eventually Baron does do it. Boom. He lands the killing blow. Finishes Lockmore Ettergun. How would you rate Lockmore Ettergun? You know, we talked over the retreat about some of our favorite villains, favorite enemies. In terms of the ones that you've had a chance to run, how would you rank him up against the... You know, the Maliras, the Tarks, the Grenzeldecks of the AP so far.
Well, I was really concerned about him being able to handle you guys. I'd read a lot of stuff about other people who play Giant Slayer and have beefed him up or done other things to make the encounter a little more difficult because there have been other parties that have just mashed him. And I was really concerned, not so much just because you guys have been doing well lately, but just concerned about a 1-on-6 Six, right? One on six situation.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, how can I make this this is a fun guy. This is an important character to this storyline that you're going on, and he's pretty dangerous. But how is one on six going to be any fun? And I was concerned about it, but I'm really happy the way it all turned out. It was a great combat.
Yeah,
Two episodes worth of combat.
But how do you rank him in terms of the villains we've had so far?
Oh.
Like, did you like him as a villain? Did you find him interesting, or was he just like another obstacle along the way?
I wasn't too excited about him beforehand, but now that I've gone through it, I do like him. Now okay. I understand. Like, because sometimes I look at a stat box and I look at the powers and I'm like, all right, well, yeah, I guess that's fine. He's got two spear attacks. He's going to do that torturous touch, which will never hit. And then he's got these other spells with really low DCs. Those aren't going to do anything. I'm like, I guess it'll be fine. But then, you know, failing on an agonized whale, failing on the torturous touch.
Right.
I was like, okay, now I like this guy. Now I get it. Sometimes I don't see on the paper how he's going to turn out in real life. And so I really like it. How would I rank it in terms of all those things? I think I liked it more than Malira. Not as much as Screed.
Okay.
But the Malira fight. Now, the Malira one, that's one that I was really excited about. And it didn't turn out the way I wanted it to. You detected
right.
all those traps under the boat. I wanted you to get somebody get trapped in those traps and then her to come out and just kill one of you, maybe, hopefully, and whatnot. But the Screed fight lived up to it. But Malira, I was really excited on paper. Didn't turn out. Lockmore, not as excited on paper. Loved the combat.
Yeah, and that can really change things for you. You know, you can look in retrospect after how the die rolls come out. You could be like, I never thought that combat would be that interesting, and it flows that way. And then, yeah, you have a greater appreciation of the character afterwards mm-hmm. than you did before. How about the combat itself? You had mentioned to me right before we hit record, you were like, I'm going to tell you something you didn't know about that combat.
Well, because I was so concerned about the one-on-six situation, I had prepared to add other creatures to the encounter. I'm not going to say what the creatures were because these creatures that I...
you want to save them?
I might want to save them for another time. I was like really excited about them because I'd never heard of these creatures before. But it was...
What, did you just pull them out of a bestiary?
You know, in the back of a lot of these adventure paths, there's like a supplement that gives you a bunch of ideas for random encounters the PCs can face. So I pulled something out of there. I just go through, I'm like, oh, this sounds interesting. But it had to make story-wise, like how do these creatures get into this sealed chamber?
Yeah.
But I had an idea of how it was going to work. So actually, I had a plan initially for when Nestor and Baron and Della went to the right, they were going to get into a fight in that room with these creatures that they could have probably handled, but it would have slowed their entrance
oh my God.
Into the tomb. So then it would have, now looking back, it would have just been Umlo and Willamette against this death machine.
Oh, it would have been a dead Umlo and Willamette riding back to the other guys, like almost certainly.
Yeah, it would have been very, very bad. But what I decided to do instead... was have the spores. You guys even said it, like, are you sure this is going to affect Della and Nestor with
yeah.
the spore range? I actually just had decided that the range of the spores was going to affect all of you guys and make you all roll on it. Technically, it should have just... I mean, technically, as written in the book, the spores only affect a smaller radius, we'll say. But, I mean, that's something I could easily be like, nope, they start going through the room. It's a sealed room. Well, you all have a chance to roll the fortitude save, and... I know you guys fail. And so that weakened you up enough so that I saw early on into the fight because you and you, Willamette, and Umlo and Ingrahild got to that fight first.
Yeah.
And when I noticed how bad it was going, because I still was keeping in my back pocket these creatures, I was like, all right, I think this is going to be good the way it is just because the party just split up the way they did.
Right.
So yeah, it was a really good encounter. And it just goes to show you, if you're not 100% sold on how something is as written, just tweak it enough depending on your party. Like, you just happen to have these two NPCs with you. They could have easily died a million times for between now and then.
Right.
You had them with you in a 6-on-1. I'm like, but it worked out great.
And you did something that we've talked about before, which is having creatures in your back pocket. Another way to level out encounters is to just have more creatures pop up if it makes story sense in some way or another. And in this case, you had him waiting in the wings, but then you held off because you thought, you're saying it early on in the fight, you realized it was not going well and it was going to be a pretty tough encounter as is, so just let it go.
Yeah, especially with a mini boss who, you know, you want him to give some, throw some minions in there just to kind of make it so people have multiple points of focus.
Yeah.
But I underestimated the Baleful Gaze and the Agonized Wail.
Oh my God, we didn't even talk about the Baleful Gaze.
Baleful Gaze was huge. I completely underestimated that because I'm like, DC 13, that's so easy to beat. I underestimate the DC 12, DC 13s. Yeah, usually they're pretty easy to beat, but all it takes is one shitty die roll.
Well, yeah, but it's not even, doesn't even have to be that shitty if you're talking about the characters that are not as willful. Is it a fortitude save or a will save for Baleful Gaze?
You had to ask me. I think it's will, but I'm honestly
either way,
guessing.
It doesn't matter. The only reason I ask is because certain classes go certain ways. Your fighters are going to have a high fortitude, but a very low will. I mean, even at 7th level, they'll probably have like a +3 will. And if they did wisdom as a dump stat, they're going to have like a +1 will or +2. So they're going to have to roll higher than 50-50 to get through that. And if they fail on that Baleful Gaze, con damage, strength damage, charisma damage. You know what I mean? Like, that is brutal for a fighter.
And look at what we've seen from Nestor so far. Killing machine. He's just been mashing, mashing, mashing. I don't know what his fortitude and will save are, but him failing on that agonized wail made him shaken. -2 to attack. He comes to the room. What does he do? Misses twice when he never misses.
Right.
So, I mean, that made a huge difference. Just taking your huge range dealing guy and making it a -2. That -2 is all it takes, especially with a guy that has an AC of 21.
So between the Baleful Gaze and the
Agonized Wail, the Torturous Touch, the spear that's doing crazy damage,
the misfire from Baron, the attacks into his allies from Nestor, we have the death of Ingerhild.
Indeed we do.
And we have some, I think, really great role-playing at the end. I think Grant did a great job. I think you did a fantastic job with Umlo. It was just, I really felt that scene. It felt really great. I mean, not like elated, but it just felt like it was good story and a good way to sort of wrap up and end that combat. And it had me thinking after the fact that, you know, it really sucks for Grant because Grant had wanted to plant some seeds. He wanted to try out a storyline with Baron and Ingerhild sort of having something going on. And
he talked to me about it like off air. He's like, maybe we could do something romantic.
How long ago do you think that was?
I'd say over a month ago, episode-wise. Over 4 episodes ago, he had started mentioning it, maybe even before that, or he had started, like, kicking around the idea, and I was like, oh, maybe we can work this out. People may think, oh, is Ingerhild supposed to die there? That's not in the book. Like, I didn't plan that, but obviously I made the attacks to do it. That's just the way the story worked. But I was interested to see if we were going to go down that path with Baron and Ingerhild, but the dice didn't
We could go back to the tape, but I feel like he said something in Trunau, like once we got back and were like cleaned up and they were just like hanging out at the bar drinking.
Oh, right when I said, you know, and Ingerhild's starting to look nice now that she doesn't have shit stains on her pants.
Made a big difference. Yeah, he started to try to plant those seeds, and obviously he kind of got the carpet pulled out from under him there, which is a shame. But it made me think about love stories in Pathfinder, and I wonder if you've ever experienced that, if you have ever either tried to run a love story with one of your characters or ever GM'd a game where someone was trying to pursue a romantic relationship as part of the role play, either with a PC or an NPC. Have you ever experimented with it?
I haven't. You know, obviously we've mentioned it before on the show. You're in my Jade Regent campaign that I run, you and Skid and now Matthew. And there's a whole mechanic built into the beginning of the game because there's 4 main NPCs that are with you from like day one in that campaign. And they're with you, you know, throughout the most of the adventure. And there's a built-in romance mechanic that they had never like had rules for before Jade Region, as far as I know.
Oh wow!
In terms of dice rolling and whatnot, and
you've never done that.
I'd never done that, and I read a lot of people's opinions on it, and a lot of people were on the fence. It's like it depends on your gaming group. Some people really like it. Some people are uncomfortable with it, like they don't want to do that. I just went in wanted to see what you guys wanted to do, and there are elements of that. If you think about like in our game of you and one of the other your character and one of the other characters, I neither encourage nor discourage it. You know what I mean? I think that you know, a love story is part of any epic adventure, so that stuff should happen and should come about.
Yeah, but I don't really know of it ever really coming to fruition in any game I've ever played in. Like, I can't think of it ever Or GM'd either. I mean, like, there's definitely been, you know, some lust-filled relationships.
Right, right.
And there's definitely been, like, I mean, even Galabras had some things with Calrie Ann Blix, sure. Stuff like that. But she wasn't really there. That was more of a crush from afar kind of thing. Like, mm-hmm. Hey, maybe that could happen one day. That would be awesome. But the idea is, you know,
to Gormley.
right. But the idea is to really build it into something like truly, like, have a true romantic relationship. I think it would make a great story to pull off in a Pathfinder game. But it would be difficult, and I wonder if you would need mechanics if you couldn't just get by with diplomacy checks.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's
sense motive.
It's an important part of a campaign. Like, who wouldn't want to see Della have a love interest, and then have that love interest or Della die? Because then, oh, that story, you build that sort of tension and then you release it by having one of the people just taken out of the equation. That's good story. That's entertainment. Oh, shit, I've got to call Matthew and figure out some...
I know, right? it's very interesting. I was very sorry for Grant that kind of got pulled away, but, you know, we'll just have to reboot and find it somewhere else.
And honestly, if that's something you want to play within your games, you got to make sure your group is okay with it. Maybe they don't want to do that. Maybe they just want to hack and slash and tell jokes. But if they want to tell an epic story and they want to try that out, I think it can be fun, as long as your group's comfortable with it.
At the end of the show, at the end of the episode, once again, we stand in the sepulcher of Nargrim Steelhand, and Umlo tells us what we must do next. One of us must cut off our arm and attach it magically to this steel hand, and now we'll be able to wield large weapons, right? That's its main function?
He's in an emotional moment right there. You know, he's laying his sister to rest, but like he's thinking, if you want to do this, you guys made me come here as much as my sister did, so I need one of you to take this charge. You know, you've made yourselves a part of this now, so who among you will be brave enough? And for the first time in Giant Slayer history, it was an NPC. I'm still shocked about this. Well, I'm going to be talking about this for weeks.
You know, I couldn't see Willamette doing it. It didn't really make a lot of sense to me. And I can totally understand why the other guys, each individually with their characters, you know, wouldn't do it. It's an odd mix of characters. But it makes me ask the question, just more in general. You know, we had the choice in front of us. We made our choice. I think that there are some obvious reasons why. But the question is, in a more general way, these extremely powerful magical items are obviously in the adventure to be given to the PCs so that they can scale and level up with what is necessary coming up. And we know what's coming up. What's coming up is giants. Giants are coming up. And what do you need to fight giants? A large...
The three things you gave to Umlo.
Right. A large reach weapon of that magnitude. So what do you think that it is, you know, an interesting choice to give an NPC powerful weapons because you feel like it fits the story better? Or do you think that's just like bad gameplay because you know you're now setting the party back? Like, what would you do? We know what you did, but you know, in the average situation as a GM, do you just try to tell the player, like, oh, look, you should probably take this? Do you, you know, level down encounters, or do you make the players pay for that choice? Like, I think that there's a lot of different ways you can go.
I don't even know if I've mentioned this to you since we recorded it, but I had every intention of having Umlo leave the story.
Well, I mean, I could tell, right?
You know, I guess I made it clear.
Near the end of the episode, you said, I'm leaving. I'm out.
Right.
We're going to burn her and I'm done. You
know? But yeah, but maybe it's like, but you know, maybe you can convince me to stay. No, I had no plans for doing that, but I don't know. I just thought you guys would want that stuff. It's going to make you powerful. Obviously, cutting off your hand. Nobody wants to maim their character, but you're maiming and getting a magical hand that allows you to do crazy things. This is another one of those instances where you guys surprised me, and now I get to take this surprise and turn it into something interesting. And I'll tell you right now, I have a very interesting idea of how I'm going to deal with it.
I'm sure you do. You always do.
That's what I do, Joe.
Well, I trust you implicitly, Troy, as always.
That's your first mistake.
You know what, buddy?
Oh,
it's time to get into
baby.
A little listener mail.
It's time for listener mail. Gotta get your brain up on it. Time for listener mail. You gotta cue that fucking A.
All we do is dance every single time.
We got some rhythm, buddy.
Just sitting in my apartment dancing.
This one comes in from Pete, who writes in from outside Everett, Washington.
Oh, Ooh.
Outside Everett, Washington.
Right.
A suburb.
He doesn't want to give his real city.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's all you need to know, Joe
Shady,
and Troy.
Shady Pete asks,
Shady Pete,
if a character fails a check, do they think
kill
they...
him!
If a character fails a check, do they think they have succeeded? Or do you allow them to realize they messed up, but were unable to tell with certainty? I'm a little confused by the wording at the end of that question, but I think I know what he's asking here, mm-hmm. which is there is a big difference between saying, like, no, you didn't see it, and saying, you see this, and it's the wrong thing.
But it's difficult because the player knows what they rolled on the die. Roll
exactly.
a perception check. Natural one. Well, now I'm going to screw with your head. But they know that what I'm saying is most likely false. So it's very, very difficult, tenuous situation. How can you do something fun with this?
Well, you know, we talked about this in a previous Cannon Fodder about a great idea that was sent to us. I mean, in our third month of the show, a fan wrote in and told us their perception theory and how they do it, where they assign different numbers to every number on the D20, or they assign a bunch of numbers that trigger in different ways. But either way, the point being, the player, if they roll a 19 or a 2, they don't know what is better or worse in that scenario.
Oh, that's interesting.
All they do is they roll the number and the GM tells them what they see.
Is that for all checks and does it change every game?
No. It's perception and it changes every game. So the first thing that... If I understand it correctly, the first thing that they do, the first thing that the GM does at the start of the session is he has the player roll like 10 perception rolls in a row.
He records all
and he writes all the numbers
Joe,
down.
Joe, 14, 15,
right. He writes all the numbers
three.
Down. Then he randomly assigns them numbers like the first roll, the second roll, the third roll, whatever. And then during the game when they roll the die, you know, whatever number came up on the die that corresponds to a different number, like a cryptogram of some kind, mm-hmm. he gives them the results based on that. So basically, there is absolutely no way for you as a player to know if your roll was good or bad. All you know is what you perceive. And I think that it is fascinating because it gives a... It truly means perception is reality to mm-hmm. you as a mm-hmm. player. What your character sees, hears, smells... That is, you have no way of knowing whether that is probably right or probably wrong.
I like that.
You know, you can go with your intuition or whatever, but even still, you're always going to be second guessing yourself.
Well, here's the problem, though. Like, if you've got a +8 to your perception, you know, it's the mechanic of the game is built towards the higher number being better. You know, you're building a character to have a better stat in that. So how does that particular system account for that difference?
No, you're getting a +8 to whatever you roll.
Right.
What you roll on the die does correspond to a random number. It's just not the number you think it is on the die. It makes no difference in terms of what Pathfinder means. Like, you do still get that bonus to the roll. You do still have a better perception than your idiot fighter, you know, but you don't know what the base number was that bonus went on top of.
I see.
Your GM knows.
Okay, that's crazy. That's a good, fun little house rule.
Yeah, it's a great house rule, but it is a lot of extra work.
Yeah, I've got a headache just thinking about it.
right. But in thinking about the answer to this question, I thought of some ways that you could do this with other skill checks, and I just started going down a road where I was like, this would be terrible. So I'm going to throw out some ideas at you. You see what you come up with.
I like it already.
Well, I mean, here's just an easy one, you know, right off the top. Stealth checks.
Mm-hmm.
You realize that an opponent could be aware of you and you not be aware that they're aware. Like, we never do that.
Yeah.
If you fail your stealth check, you're like, hey, roll for initiative. They see you. You don't get a surprise round.
Right.
Or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, you could totally have it be like, you know, you rolled a 12 on your stealth check. You're like, okay, you walk up. His back's to you. Doesn't seem to see anything. Da-da-da. And meanwhile, you're like, he's readying an action to grapple as soon as he gets within melee range or something.
If I ever did that to Skid, he would jump over
exactly.
the table and strangle me.
That's the whole point of this discussion is like, have you ever even thought of doing this? I never thought of doing this before.
I don't think I could. I think Skid would actually strangle me if I ever did that. That is an amazing idea.
Think about it.
Playing possum.
Well, think about it out of combat. Think about it just, you know, you're walking through an area. I mean, this does actually happen, technically speaking, where, you know, the players still think that they've been disguised, but somebody saw them, warned somebody else, they're coming around to get them, whatever.
Right.
How about disabled device? Would it be the biggest dick move in the world to fail to roll a 23 on a disabled device and say it appears to be untrapped, but it's not? And then... they trigger the trap.
Oh, I would absolutely do that. I feel like I have done that.
No,
you don't do that?
Well, no, I mean, if you fail...
If it's a DC 25 disabled device and you roll a 23, I usually just say, oh, sorry, you didn't do it?
Yeah, you didn't do it.
Oh.
Or you can trigger the trap, but right. and that's normal too. But there are some traps that don't trigger just because you fail.
I think you have to fail by 5 or more or something like that.
Right, exactly.
Oh, so I like that idea. So if it was DC 28 and you rolled a 23, I'd be like, shh, you got it.
Got it.
All right, I open the chest.
Exactly.
Fireball trap.
Right, exactly, because you think you had it. I think that would be so mean.
That's great. Hold on, Joe. I got to write that down.
Oh, shit. Shit.
That's great.
How about knowledge checks?
Mm.
We never do this. Give misinformation on failed knowledge checks.
Oh, that's great.
Dude, you fail a history check, deliberately give them something that leads them down the wrong way. And not, you know, to the extent that it ruins the path of the game, but to the extent that they think something to be true and they're convinced of it as players that is just not true. But you know how realistic that is?
That's interesting.
You think of a rumor or somebody, you know, one person in your party says, oh, I remember this. You know, historically, the Osirians do this, that, and the other thing.
Right.
And, you know, because they're repeating what the GM told them, and then they use that in some sort of diplomacy check that the bard does, and then the person is like, you are lying.
Lock him up.
Exactly.
You know what I like about this? It just requires a little extra prep for the DM. So when you see in the book that, like, all right, a DC 15 knowledge history is going to tell them this information, you need to plan what the false information is going to be that will completely screw the PCs if they use it incorrectly.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. How about you're fighting some construct, right? And what is it? A knowledge engineering, maybe? I think it is.
Dungeoneering, I think, for a construct. Knowledge
dungeoneering. Yeah. So roll a knowledge dungeoneering check, and it's like close, but they fail. You're like, this creature has...
It's immune to fire.
Is immune to fire. And it's
or
just,
weak to fire. And then just, the guy preps his, like,
yes.
You know, fireball spell. Oh, I'm like, oh, did I say weak?
I meant immune!
Sucker! Fist fight.
We never do that.
This would cost so many fist fights.
I know.
Now, here's one I like. Climb checks. Because climb checks in Pathfinder can be a real pain in the ass. You move quarter speed. Nobody wants to do all the math. What if everybody has to climb? It's like, all right, roll 10 climb checks. I'll get you up there. I like a failed climb check. You sprain your leg for a week. Minus 10 to movement for the next 7 days of gameplay.
That's so brutal.
Minus 10 to movement because you got a bum leg like Lork. I just came up with that on the spot. That's a great idea.
I mean, yes, there are some, like an acrobatics check to jump a 10-foot gap is a DC 10. If you roll a 9, you fail. If you roll a 10, you succeed. There isn't much really to go on there. You can't really think you succeeded when you didn't. Same with like a swim check or a handle animal check. Like, you're not going to think you succeeded and not, unless you have a really tricky animal. But what about sense motive? I mean, that is one of the most obvious ones where if you fail it, you should be deliberately thinking something else. Like, the GM should be giving the player an answer, not a no answer.
Right.
An answer that is wrong. You fail, they're lying.
Yeah.
And they're telling the truth. And the player's like, don't lie to me. You know, and they're like, I'm not lying. You know, I know you're lying. It could cause a fight. It could cause a murder.
Right.
Over the wrong thing because of the wrong check. You know, I mean, that one's a little bit more obvious, but you know what we never do? Survival checks. You fail a survival check. You don't find anything. You don't see tracks. You don't know where they go. What if you follow the wrong tracks?
Yes.
What if they send you in the wrong direction?
Takes you days in the wrong direction. Random encounter.
Random encounter. And then what are your rations at? How much food do you have left? Do you have enough water? Oh, and then you have to actually roll actual survival checks for like starvation and thirst and stuff.
Good.
How good is that? So then I thought, I was literally thinking of these and I thought, well, you know, another one that is just like a DC and either you do it or you don't is heal. Like you do a heal check to like staunch the bleeding. You either staunch the bleeding or you don't. And then I went, oh my God.
You make it worse.
Imagine if you did a heal check to diagnose a poison and failed it. The GM says, you think this is filth fever. It's not even a poison. It's a disease, as it turns out. You drink a very expensive potion of remove disease and nothing happens.
Or what if you fail the heal check and you were like, you weren't careful enough diagnosing it, you contract the poison.
I didn't even think of that one.
I thought that's where you were going with that.
No.
It's like, let me just take a look at this poison. Natty one. Well, guess who... Guess who has minus four to their con now?
Oh, man, I didn't think of that.
Brutal.
No, I was just thinking about like how you could misdiagnose things.
Right.
And then that could create like major wastes of
resources.
Resources, yeah.
And, you know, opposing a restoration isn't cheap.
And then, you know, I thought about the perception checks and how you could really lead people in the total wrong direction with perception. I don't know.
Well, here, let me throw this out at you, Joe. It can also be situations where you don't necessarily have to mislead or try and trick the PCs, but you can just make them you can force them to change their action based on their failed check. Perfect example. Della, in the fight, in the one-on-one fight when you were going against Kargik, is going towards Umlo. She rolled a perception check to see if he was alive.
Appeared to be alive.
I think she rolled like a three.
She rolled a natty one.
A natty one. I was like, you are 100% sure he's dead.
Yes.
Now, there's nothing math you can do that's going to allow me to make him go over there because he's 100% sure he's dead.
Right.
So that wasn't a situation where I was tricking him. I just, it forced Matthew to make a different decision what to do with his character.
Right, but Matthew is at this point an experienced enough player that he knew he rolled a natural one. He knew that Umlo was alive.
Right.
But he had to do something else with his character. The reason I like the other way, and we're never going to do it, but the reason I like it is because he truly wouldn't know. The player really wouldn't know.
Yeah.
And it would cause conflict, like in his own head, you know, which is a fun way to play because it's creating that indecision and tension that's in the actual environment of the character.
Yeah.
You know, you're kind of pulling that out too. Are there any other checks we're missing? I mean, bluff checks, obviously. You could totally fail a bluff check and you as the GM could tell him you bluff the person. But the person could just be a cool customer,
right?
That knows they're being lied to, and it's just like, oh yeah, cool. Well, look, I'll tell you. You want to stay here for the night? We'll set you up. We'll get you set up with a bed, whatever, and then locks them in, you know, and just throws poison smoke in the room, whatever. You know what I mean? You could totally go back and say you actually failed that bluff check.
Yeah, there just has to be repercussions for failed skill checks. You know what I mean?
We've said this before. Don't go with the null result.
You know,
try to find some other repercussion. But I mean, some of these ideas are nasty, man.
It's going to require a little more prep time on the GM, but you should just, in your spare time, GMs, just start writing little lists of possible repercussions for acrobatics checks and heel checks, and then just have them in your back pocket. Like, oh, was that natty one? Hold on, let me just look at my book here. Oh, you're automatically dead from that failed bluff check.
You could do a craft alchemy check, fail it, be like, oh, no, you made the potion, but you made a potion of long arm and didn't realize it.
Yeah.
But you know it as a player, but your character doesn't know it. So the next time you're down on HP and you want to drink that potion to cure light wounds, you have to drink that. And then you have a long arm.
Handle animal. You fail a handle animal, roll an natty one, Lexington bites Willamette. And crits.
You had to go with the crit.
Just like, oh, yes. you touched in the wrong way.
Oh man, so many good ideas.
So many good stuff.
We should do this more often. Like, come up with ideas to be terrible people to your players.
Yeah, I mean that's the best way to GM. I think. Make it near impossible.
All right, guys, that's going to do it for us this week. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. Remember, write us at glasscannonpodcast@gmail.com. Let us know what you think about the shows. Let us know what you think about Cannon Fodder, and let us know what questions you want answered. The questions keep coming in, and as you can see, they're great, and they get us thinking in incredibly awesome new ways to be terrible to people. And I highly recommend that you write in and get yours on the air. Troy, thank you, buddy. It's always a pleasure. I will see you next week.
Oh, man. Man, business is about to pick up.
I'm terrified.